Welcome, everyone. I'll remind you as we jump into our conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the University of Maryland Transplant Program. Nearly 2,000 Marylanders are waiting for an organ transplant. The University of Maryland conducts research and performs procedures designed to optimize transplant rates and provide least invasive surgeries for organ donors. More information about the University of Maryland's transplant program and becoming an organ donor is available online at umm.edu/transplant. We are joined here by Dr. Rashid Khalidi, who is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. His latest book that we will be talking to him about in the coming week or two is called Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. And Jason Isaacson, Director of Government and International Affairs for the American Jewish Committee, and Rashid Khalidi and Jason Isaacson. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Jump on our Facebook page. We'll see what you have to say there. So for many in the press, no matter whether they support President Barack Obama or lean one way or the other in the Middle East world, in wars and in conflicts, are all asking the question, Rashid Khalidi, why is this trip being made? It feels by many to be a trip with a lot of symbolism, but not a lot of substance. Or am I? What is your read?
I think that might be correct. It's hard to see precisely what the president intends with this trip, besides general reassurance to Israel and the Israeli people. He clearly is not carrying with him any major initiative insofar as Palestinian-Israeli issues are concerned. And even the Iraq, the topic of Iraq, which he apparently has been discussing with the Israeli prime minister, is not a burning one at the moment. It's one that I'm sure they need to talk about. But my sense is that this is sort of the obligatory trip the American president, by the time his second term comes around, has to make. And he's doing it at the beginning of his second term. But I really don't see that there are major issues that are going to come up during this visit. So far, that doesn't seem to be the case.
And how do you interpret this trip, Jason?
I actually interpret it as a very positive development. I think that the alliance between the United States and Israel is not only important to the people of Israel, it's important to peace in that region. It's certainly important to the security interests of the United States, as the president made very clear today when he arrived in Israel and when he spoke then in a press conference with Prime Minister Netanyahu. So I disagree. I think it is a substantive trip, not in the sense that there are deliverable hardware packages or some other big-ticket things that are being discussed, but in terms of the symbolism of America's alliance with Israel and America's support for a two-state solution, as well as America's recognition of the threats posed by one particular country in the region that threatens Arab states as well as Israel, I think that it's extremely important.
So let me push that a bit further, Jason Isaacson. Just in terms of, most presidents who have gone to Israel, whether the plans have not usually worked, but have come with some kind of Mideast peace plan, a plan of peace between Palestinians and Israelis. But that seems to be not even in the picture in terms of the conversation from our government with Israel and the Palestinians. So what do you think the purpose of the trip is? I mean, is this a trip that is to kind of shore up the issues around Iran, Syria? I mean, what is the substance of the trip? What do you think it's really saying? We know the United States, our policies are to support Israel, and that has not changed President Barack Obama or anybody previous. So what do you think is really coming out of this trip?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure, Mark, that that previous presidents have come with a peace plan in their pockets. And I don't think that it's something that we require of American presidents. What we require is, or rather what the American public should expect of American presidents is that they support peace in that region and that they will help the parties reach peace between themselves. The president made that very clear today. And I think he will make that same message, that same point when he meets with President Abbas and Prime Minister Fayyad when he's in Ramallah tomorrow as well. I think that's important. What else is substantive is that, yes, the United States has profound security interests in the region, is interested in stability, is interested in assuring that terrorism does not gain ground, that people who wish to impose their will on others by force are not allowed to succeed, that weapons of mass destruction do not proliferate. He will make all of these points in consultation with America's staunch ally, Israel.
Rashid?
Yeah, I actually have nothing to add to that. I think that the idea that Israel is any kind of security asset for the United States is actually quite mistaken. I think that Israel constitutes a huge drag on American interests, frankly. During the Cold War, it could be argued that Israel was an American ally as against Soviet allies, or rather regional proxies for the Soviet Union, and that was a very strong argument in those days. Since the Cold War, I think it's really arguable that Israel has gotten the United States into a lot of problems. People who were involved in the American occupation of Iraq made that very, very clear, both in the Pentagon and in the military, that overt American bias for Israel, which everybody in the world perceives, on the lack of an even-handed American position, very much skews perceptions of the United States, not just in the Arab world, but all over the world. And so Israel is quite a drag, I think, to the United States internationally. So I think that there's a domestic political imperative involved here because, you know, there's a very powerful lobby that argues for the strength of the American-Israeli relationship. And many, many Americans support that. There's no question about it. But the idea that Israel is some kind of strategic asset is an idea that the Israelis and their friends in the United States put about, but I don't think it really holds up, certainly not since the end of the Cold War.
Well, one of the things that I think that is really important to kind of wrestle with here, since I don't think it's going to really come out in the conversations in the next few days with this trip to Israel and Jordan, when I was looking at what Yuri Ariel was saying the other day, who is the new minister of housing in Israel, and comes from a leader of the party that represents a lot of the settler interests in Israel. I mean, he said that we want to build, this is just before President Barack Obama arrived, settlements from the Mediterranean to the Jordan, and that he meant no disrespect to Palestinian people, but he had to look out for Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. He said a couple of other interesting things, like all they can look forward to is autonomy and...
And that so if that is what the United States and the international community is faced with when they're trying to figure out how to negotiate a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine, how does that even begin? I mean, that I know it's not going to come up in the next couple of days, but I think that is something that is kind of lurking as a subtext behind some of what's going on. Rashid and Jason, I mean, how do we address that?
Well, I don't think the president is going to address it. I mean, he did try apparently to address it in his first term, and he was slapped down, especially after the Republicans won control of the House in 2010. And I doubt that he's going to repeat that experience. But I think it's a good point because the idea that Israel can build settlements uninterruptedly, which it has been doing, you know, for decades now, tripling the settler population since the so-called peace process began in 1991 until today, till well over 500,000 people in the occupied territories, and can actually be serious about wanting a two-state solution. That's simply illogical. It's clear evidence that what this leader, important, you know, I think he's somebody worth listening to, and I think he doesn't just represent his own party. I think he very much represents the views of the prime minister.
That goes a little too far, if I may, Dr. Khalidi. I think that really one must have to take one's cues from what the prime minister himself says. It's very difficult to assemble a government in the kind of coalition that is required in the Israeli democratic system. It's very different from our own, where you have many different parties that need to be somehow stitched together into a single cohesive government. And yes, you do have a leader of a party that has represented settlers' interests in this coalition in a prominent position, but he's not the prime minister. He doesn't command a majority in the coalition. His voice is it was representative of a portion of the Israeli public, but not representative of the Israeli government. I think that would be stretching too far. Let's see what the policies are that this government articulates. And also, let's not forget that the prime minister again said today, as he has said in the past, and quite sincerely, that he favors a two-state solution, an independent Palestinian state side by side with Israel. This is the position of the United States. It is the position that will have to emerge from negotiations, and that's what we should be aiming for. And I believe that that's very much on the president's mind as he goes about his business in that region.
It may be on the president's mind, and those are certainly the words of the Israeli prime minister. But I think one should, with the Israelis in particular, one should look at what they do at least as much as one looks at what they say. And the people who held the housing ministry from Ariel Sharon before he became prime minister right through the current incumbent in this new government are the people whose actions, together with the defense ministry, have determined outcomes. I mean, the sweet words that Israeli prime ministers say to public opinion in the United States, or for that matter in Israel, where in both cases there are majorities in favor of a two-state solution in the United States and in Israel. There are majorities that are not really favorable to the settlement enterprise. There are majorities that are not favorable to occupation. What they say is a lot less important than what their governments have done. And, you know, the increase in the number of settlers from 200,000 to close to 600,000. In fact, Prime Minister Netanyahu, speaking to Congress in May of last year, said 650,000. That might be a slight exaggeration. But those actions speak to my way of thinking, and I think should speak to all of us, a lot louder than whatever honeyed words the Prime Minister may be saying.
Nevertheless, if I may, Dr. Flutie, I take your point, but the fact is that a percentage of land in the West Bank that is occupied by Israeli settlers, as they are called, is still a very small percentage. That the fact is that if people sit down at the bargaining table and work out borders, this will no longer be an issue. It's important that the Palestinians get back to the bargaining table, as Israel has offered them an opportunity to do.
Well, I spent 2 years at a bargaining table back in 91 to 93, and that was a long time ago. I know it's ancient history, but as I point out in my book, I think there are a lot of lessons from the decades of Palestinian attempts to sit at a bargaining table that was skewed in various ways, where the United States was not acting as an honest broker, and where outcomes were excluded by Israeli actions. And it's not as if this is new. It's not as if the settlement issue arose in 2010 or 2011 or last year. This is an issue that's been there since Prime Minister Begin negotiated the Camp David Accords in 1978. This is an issue that bedeviled our negotiations in the early 1990s. And it hasn't gotten better. In fact, it has gotten worse. So I frankly think that talking about coming back to negotiations, coming back to a process that has conclusively, comprehensively failed over 35 years to bring about peace, that has left the Palestinians infinitely worse off. The Israelis are not suffering from these outcomes. Israel controls the land. Israel controls the water. Israel controls security. Israelis aren't vexed when they move about. Palestinians are penned in ways today that they were not in 1991. They have less access to their own land than they did in 1991. I could go on and on. My point is to talk about going back to the process is say go back in the cage, the limits of which are defined by others, and just shut up. Don't be violent, heaven forbid. Don't engage in, heaven forfend, lawfare. In fact, do nothing except sit inside a negotiating process whose outcome is circumscribed. I don't think it's going to be very easy to get the Palestinians to play that game for much longer. 35 years is a very, very long time. 20 years of negotiations is a very, very long time. And there's a lovely expression in Arabic, which takrar bi'allim hamar, repetition teaches even a donkey. I mean, even the leaders of the PA, with all due respect, even those Palestinian leaders who've been engaged in this process for a very, very long time, I think they're very wary of their own public opinion on this issue, because people have seen the results of this negotiation. It has not led to peace. It hasn't led to Palestinian self-determination. It hasn't led to anything positive as far as the Palestinians are concerned, unfortunately.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Dr. Flutie, but the fact is that it hasn't been 35 years of negotiations. It's been off and on negotiations, and for the last several years, it's been really nothing. There have been some quiet talks that have taken place between certain individuals, but there hasn't been full-on negotiations for a very long time. It's important that we get back to something like that with the United States looking at this program, looking at these negotiations, and playing some kind of a role in facilitating these negotiations, with the quartet playing the role that it has set out for itself in this process. The world will be looking over the shoulders of both sides as they come to the bargaining table and set about the business of settling this historic conflict. I think it's important that we start that process.
I wonder if you know, we've been interviewing people in Israel and on the West Bank and Gaza and throughout, and you get this sense that Jason Isaacson, whether it's people who in Israel who do support the expansion of settlements throughout the West Bank and more, or whether it is even those who many Israelis who do not support the settlements and would like them to stop, or Palestinians who are trying to take a nonviolent path. A lot of them are. The American press doesn't cover very much. That there is a resignation, almost an emotional resignation by many, that we have gone beyond the time when a two-state solution is even viable, if things continue to move in the direction they're going. And I And I'm just curious. I mean, I've read a lot about you that you've written and said over the years, and so I'm just curious. I mean, how you view that? I mean, how you view this kind of very frustrated feeling, I think, among Palestinians and Israelis that we're reaching a point of almost too late.
Is that a question to me or to Mr.?
That's for you first, Jason.
Mark, thank you. I don't disagree that there are people who are frustrated on both sides and people who are losing hope on both sides. Absolutely, that's the case. And we don't have forever to work this out. We are reaching a point where it is really essential that the leaders of both sides take this seriously, move back to the bargaining table. The Palestinian leadership has talked about that, but they haven't come back to the table. There was a brief flurry of negotiations a couple of years ago. It petered out. It started too late. It ended too early. Let's start again. But yes, of course, Palestinians are frustrated. Israelis are frustrated. And yet, majorities on the Israeli side consistently support a two-state solution. But they are fearful, or they're skeptical, rather, that there is leadership on the other side that can make the compromises necessary, sell those compromises to their people after generations of preaching this negative imagery of Jews and of Israel and of Jews' right to be in that land. So there's a lot of suspicion, a lot of skepticism on both sides. I know that exists certainly on the Palestinian side as well. We have to cut through that. It's going to require leadership. The president will do what he can to help, but it's going to require Palestinian leadership to meet the hands of Israeli leaders.
Rashid, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that you've asked a very good question about whether it's too late to have a two-state solution. The late Tony Judd once said that what any politician has done, another politician can undo. And I believe that that's true. I believe that, you know, it would be conceivable for the occupation to be rolled back. It would be conceivable for the settlement enterprise to be dismantled. It would be conceivable for Israel to give the Palestinians control over the eastern part of Jerusalem and so on and so forth. But frankly, I don't see those things happening. I see that the dynamic inside Israel over the last several decades has been in another direction. And at a time when that wasn't the case in the Palestinian side, when there was wholehearted Palestinian commitment to a two-state solution, I remember the joy at the time of the Madrid peace conference. I remember the joy at the time of the Oslo Accords, when people, Israelis actually and Palestinians, actually thought something could be done. Since then, that has changed, and it's changed mainly because of Israeli actions. I mean, there have been all kinds of things on both sides you can point to, but the things that have made a two-state solution impossible are not attitudes. The things that have made a two-state solution impossible, or at least extremely difficult, are, you know, facts on the ground, things that people were assiduously doing with the support of Israeli governments, and I regret to say, with the support of our government, with the bankrolling of our government, with arms from our government, with tax-deductible donations going to the building of illegal settlements by extremists, 501c3s gathering money all over this country that's being funneled to the settlement enterprise. Those facts on the ground are what I think calls into question the feasibility of a two-state solution. It's not, you know, these people are disappointed or those people are not at the table or whatever. That's a result of a situation that has been created by decades of systematic work to make a two-state solution impossible. I mean, when Mr. Isaacson says, well, that's just one minister and one government, I mean, you have to go right back to Prime Minister Begin, you have to go back to Prime Minister Shamir, you have to go back to the ideologues who really laid down the lines for the political parties that have dominated Israel since 1977 and see that they were working assiduously such that there could never be Palestinian sovereignty in what they saw as the greater land of Israel, such that there could never be a situation where anyone but Israel controlled security, and so on and so forth. And sadly, not only have they succeeded, we, the United States, have in effect endorsed and supported and run interference for and bankrolled that process. So if there's no two-state solution, you can certainly blame the Palestinians. I mean, in my writing, I talk about Palestinian failures, Palestinian mistakes, things that the Palestinians could and should have done. God knows the Palestinians and the Arabs bear their share of blame for many of these outcomes, but the concrete wasn't poured by Palestinians. The settlements, the bypass roads, the checkpoints, the things that structurally make this very, very, the legal system that's been imposed, I think those things you can't blame on the Palestinians. You can blame them on the United States in part, because we have run interference for this process from the very beginning. We have endorsed it. We have protected it. But I think that those are the problems that make a two-state solution so very difficult to conceive of today.
If I may.
Please, go ahead.
I recognize that that Israel is not blameless in some of these issues, of course. But I would like to at least say that that there is a good deal of Palestinian blame to go around as well. And Dr. Khalidi has said that there is some of that. But I think, you know, he's left out some important things. The fact that more than 1,000 Israelis were killed by Palestinian suicide bombers and other terrorists in the course of several years. The fact that Israel has, I think, rightly come to doubt the commitment on the part of the Palestinian leadership to deliver after decades of preaching hatred and rejection of Israel, after Arab states have added to that chorus of rejection of Israel's presence in that region. It is entirely understandable that Israelis would be skeptical of Palestinian leadership after this kind of appeasement or encouragement of the most complete and violent rejection of Israel's presence. The Israeli people want to live in peace with their neighbors. They have demonstrated that again and again. They have reached peace with Egypt, and it's been a good peace, a cold peace, not a peace that has lived up to the expectations of either people, but it's been peace. They are at peace with Jordan. They would like peace with the Palestinians, but we need Palestinian leadership that is able to deliver on that.
We only have a few minutes left in the segment. I wonder what, but this is very quick, because we literally have like 3 minutes left before we have to go to break in our next segment. But when you look at the demonstrations taking place throughout the West Bank and demonstrations that took place today within Israel by mostly Palestinian but some Israeli activists with them that were peaceful demonstrations, what do you think is going to happen if those things grow in intensity? How is that going to affect the peace process and what happens? And literally, I said we have about 2.5 minutes. Rashid, very quickly, and then Jason, and then we'll have...
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not a prognosticator. I'm a historian. I don't know where this is going to go. I would suggest that the proper future for the Palestinians is not violent, but rather nonviolent resistance. But that this occupation should be resisted after all of these decades. In June, we're going into the 47th year of Israeli occupation. That this could not and has not been dismantled by now is a scandal. And claiming, oh, they don't like us or whatever, I don't think that's the issue. I think it's practices that Israel is engaged in that have led to anger and unhappiness on the Palestinian side. And that's what has to, I think, be looked at. And I think that there's going to be more of this. I mean, you have to put yourself in the shoes of people who lived under foreign military rule without any rights for 2.5 generations to understand that this is not just a little bit of frustration. This is far beyond frustration. You have to talk about a people a quarter of whose or a third of whose young men have been through Israeli prisons. I mean, we're talking about a whole population of several million people that has never had full and equal rights. And so, one way or another, I think they have to. And I don't know how this is going to go, but I think that in fact, those protests are part of a larger nonviolent wave that actually we get very little coverage, unfortunately, in the United States.
And Jason, I'm sorry, I have about a minute left. Do you want to have a closing thought?
Well, thank you. Nor were there Palestinian rights under Jordanian occupation of the West Bank, nor under Egyptian occupation of Gaza. Israel has offered Palestinian rights and Palestinian statehood, but it needs to be negotiated, and that's why we should point both leaderships in the direction of the bargaining table. The United States will be standing there to help facilitate. This needs to be solved. It can be solved. This problem was made by people. It can be solved by people.
Jason Isaacson is Director of Government and International Affairs for the American Jewish Committee. Dr. Rashid Khalidi is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. His latest book is Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. We look forward to interviewing him in the next week or so about his latest work. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
It's been a pleasure. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined by Craig and Cindy Corey, whose daughter was killed while she was an activist in Israel, to talk about their work for peace and what they're doing. And other voices coming from the Middle East as well after that. So stay with us. And then we look at some issues around homelessness and more after the top of the hour. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to start a conversation with Craig and Cindy Corey, parents of Rachel Corey, the 23-year-old, college student from Washington State who was killed by the Israeli military 10 years ago this month. And they are co-founders of the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice. And Craig and Cindy, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
I wish one of you would just describe for listeners, many of whom may not know what we're talking about in terms of your daughter, and what happened, and if you'd just like to kind of I hate to do this, but revisit that just for a moment to talk about what happened on that day, which we will post on our website. But please, I know Craig or Cindy, who would like to do that?
I'd be glad to share with you,
you
a little about that. Rachel was in Gaza, in Rafah, which is at the southern tip of the Gaza Strip. It is a city that borders with Egypt. She was there with other internationals who were part of something called the International Solidarity Movement. They had come to that area really because there had been a resolution in the United Nations to bring a human rights monitoring force to the region after violence had erupted in the year 2000. And that resolution was vetoed by the United States with the support of Israel, with the encouragement of Israel. And so a Palestinian-led movement was formed to encourage internationals to come and to stand with Palestinians who were threatened in various ways by what was happening to them under occupation. At this particular place, there were at the time massive clearing demolitions to widen what was a very narrow border strip called the Philadelphia Corridor. But the Israelis made the decision to broaden that strip, and in doing so, they took out block after block of Palestinian homes. It was only one of the things that Rachel was doing in Gaza at the time, but she and the others would go, and they would try to challenge these bulldozers. These were Caterpillar-built D9R bulldozers armored in Israel, and they're weapons, really, used for destruction of homes and other things in that area. Rachel and the others were called that day because there were two bulldozers threatening homes and structures in the area. They worked there for several hours. The bulldozers would come up to the feet of the activists and stop. One activist had been pushed into some concertina wire, but then the bulldozer stopped. At about 5 p.m. that day, one of the bulldozers, each of them had two soldiers inside, a driver and a commander, made a run toward a house where Rachel had stayed and knew the family, knew that the children and the families were watching from behind the wall of their garden what was happening. And on that particular run, the bulldozer did not stop. It continued over Rachel, then paused and backed over her again, and she died shortly after that.
I remember when that happened again. I mean, I know it's been a while, but 10 years ago, but I still... I'm still very sad, and my condolences are with you forever.
Thank you.
Our prayers are with you forever. So talk about the Foundation for Peace and Justice, what you're doing now. And I'm really interested in this in terms of what we saw in the news today. I don't know if you saw the news today where there were dozens of demonstrators in Israel, most of them Palestinian, but many Israelis as well, who were wearing the Martin Luther King masks, who were singing freedom songs. I woke up this morning with freedom on my mind. And when they were attacked by settlers, and then the soldiers came in and arresting four Palestinians and others. But that is happening all over the place right now. So I'm wondering, I don't know if that has a connection with the work you're doing or not, but tell us about that.
Well, actually, I hadn't seen that, so I'm glad you told me about it, because I get goosebumps running down the back of my neck when I hear about it. We do try, as Rachel was trying to do, to reach out to people in Israel and Palestine on a grassroots level, so sort of bypassing, for the most part, the governments. We personally have worked with our government and have been in touch with the Israeli government and Palestinian governments. But we're trying to do this on a grassroots level, like Rachel did. So families that are in Gaza or the West Bank and families that are in Israel. You know, right after Rachel was killed, we were contacted by some Israeli Jews who had taken out an ad in the English Haaretz newspaper, and with just giving their condolences and their, I think, in a sense, gratitude that Rachel was over there and people like her. So we have many Jewish friends in Israel, and of course 20% of the Israeli people are Palestinian, and we have many friends among them, those people as well. So we're familiar with many of those demonstrations, although I was not the one that went on today, and I'm grateful that they were doing that.
So again, tell us more, Cindy, about the work. I mean, what you're actively involved in.
Right. Our work focuses on education, a lot of it here in the United States, because we feel that Americans need to understand that we have huge responsibility here. Recently, and just this past weekend, we marked the 10th anniversary of Rachel's killing in Gaza, and we did that by bringing, really hosting hundreds of people here in Olympia to hear from Phyllis Bemis from the Institute of Policy Studies, from Ramzi Baroud, who is editor of the Palestine Chronicle and is formerly from Gaza, and to hear their perspectives on where we've been these past 10 years and where we're going, and also thinking about the Obama visit this week to Israel. We also went last week up to our state legislature. Some people would say, why go to the state legislature? But the point that we wanted to make is that there are decisions being made at the federal level to use our tax dollars to support the Israeli occupation. And while initially President Obama came out strongly opposing settlement development, the administration backed away from that. And we have a situation now in Israel where the new cabinet is actually, if anything, more pro-settlement development than the previous one was. So I think our work, a lot of it is focused on just having people here understand that while we may not be able to control everything that happens in Israel and Palestine, we should be able to manage what happens with our own tax dollars here in the United States. In the next 10 years, in this 10-year period, over $731 million just from my state alone, from Washington State, is going to go to support that occupation. And all the ramifications of it that are illegal under international law. And we think that that money could be put to better use here at home, and that that's something that maybe we can do something about. So we're educating. We're also building the connections that Craig spoke to you about. We've taken delegations to Gaza. Craig and I, actually working with Interfaith Peace Builders, I co-led delegations to Israel, to the West Bank and Gaza last fall. I think always when people can visit and see for themselves what's happening there, always they come back with a determination to do something here in the United States. And I think that's terribly important. We work with Art and the Written Word. We have a beautiful mural in downtown Olympia that's really, we call it the Olympia Ruffa Solidarity Mural. Its emphasis is really on how all of these issues, social justice issues, are connected. And there are many different issues and many different artists reflected in that mural. And finally, as Craig said, we work to support grassroots movements to work on these issues. So the work is kind of broad. We're very, very busy, and we hope it makes some difference.
And so when you say you support local grassroots efforts, how do you do that? I mean, how exactly does that work?
Well, one of the things that we're hoping to do this year, it's kind of difficult because of but we're trying to bring a young man from Gaza to come here, and he's worked with the Rachel Corrie Youth and Cultural Center in Rafa. He, I think, was about, I'm going to guess, around 17, 16 years old when Rachel was killed. And so 10 years later, he's been a volunteer for many years at this center, and he's now the paid person there. But we're trying to get him to come to the United States and maybe take some leadership programs that he devises, talk with some people about strategies to help youth with ongoing trauma because of it's not post-traumatic, but it's during the traumatic syndrome sort of thing that they're living with now, and see if something like, you know, if we can be of some help to him and also just sort of give him some breathing room so he can reflect on what he's trying to do and come back and do that better. We've supported in Gaza, some friends of Rachel's, friends of ours, have supported organized a football, we call it soccer, but a football tournament that goes around their holiday, month-long holiday of Ramadan. So they have a Rachel Corrie Memorial Ramadan football tournament. And we've been lucky enough to go there a few years ago and actually see the end of that. So So we've worked with them. We also, in terms of in the United States, there's a program that was initiated by Palestinians called Boycott, Divestments, and Sanctions, and trying to use the tools that we use with South Africa and with the apartheid program that was going on in South Africa to break that apartheid. And so we've been educating around that and supporting people that will work on that that issue here. So that's another thing we've been doing that can be done at the grassroots level.
So I'm just curious, when this tragedy happened to your daughter, being run over by a bulldozer in Israel by the Israelis in Gaza, were you involved in this before that happened, or is this something that has spurred on since Rachel was murdered?
We were not involved at all. I think we're typical of many American families who had always heard about this issue through news reports, but had kind of tuned out what was happening there. It was that problem that was just never going to go away. And it was really Rachel that brought us to the issue. If our family had an allegiance, I think it was certainly to the Israeli Jewish narrative, because that's what we knew most about. I think Palestinians, right in our own community, were invisible to us. So Rachel, before she went to Gaza, started to educate us. We weren't living in the same place at the time, but when I would come here to visit her, she would check out films from the Evergreen State College Library, and we would watch them together. And she talked to me about what I thought about what I was seeing. And it was all the degree to which she was learning about it, knew about it, that was all very new to me. And I'm really grateful to Rachel for really the preparation that she provided in the months before she left. And then, of course, once she got there, and she was a writer, and once she started to share with our family and friends what she was observing and witnessing, it just opened up the issue to us in a new way, because we knew about her as a writer. We knew how careful she was with her words, how important observation. She was a good observer, and we knew how important it was to her to be accurate and so forth. So when she started to write about what she was witnessing, that really just opened up the issue to not only Craig and me, but all of our family and friends.
I'd also, just when you asked that question, you talked about the murder of Rachel, and I'd just say that up until really right now, our family has not referred to it as murder, and I think our son was the first to say, you know, we have to keep an open mind if we're asking the rest of the world to keep an open mind about what happened. Now, we've been in a years-long lawsuit in which many people from the Israeli military came and testified, and after their dissembling, I think, to me, it seems pretty clear that one of the two people in that bulldozer saw Rachel before she was killed, and so that would make it murder. But I just think that particularly your listeners, you know, need to come to this whole issue, not just our daughter, but the whole issue with an open mind, try to investigate all the facts, and not worry about who did what until they find out what was done, so that we don't react differently. I think we should be as outraged by the actions of one group as another there, but the overwhelming force is on the part of the Israelis. What was done with Rachel, you know, that is a huge bulldozer, and they are responsible for what's in front of the blade. I was in Vietnam. I, in part, was in charge of bulldozers. Hmm. And you are responsible for what's done in front of the blade. So anyway, I just would like people to look at this with an open mind and look for the justice in all of it and work together to try to see that that there is eventual justice and peace in the Middle East.
I want to thank both of you for joining us today and for your continued work for peace and the open hearts and minds the two of you work with, Craig and Cindy Corey, of course, parents of Rachel Corey, the 23-year-old college student from Washington State who was killed by an Israeli military 10 years ago this month, and now co-founders of the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice. All the information for that contact will be on our website at steinershow.org, so you can contact them and see what work they're doing and support it. Craig and Cindy Corey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure and honor to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.